This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Wow, Santa Fe, how's it going? Y'all hear me good? Yeah? Okay, yeah, louder. Well, I'm really happy to be here tonight. My name is Clayton Thomas Mueller. I'm a Cree man from northern Manitoba, Canada, and I work with the Indigenous Environmental Network as their tar sands campaign director. Thank you. Yeah. And, you know, for many years, we've been supporting frontline Indigenous communities who are fighting against the world's largest and most destructive project known as the Canadian tar sands. And, of course, this oil development has many, many tentacles. It's a monster, really, and there are pipelines that they are proposing from this monster that spread out all across Turtle Island, and shipping lanes, new refineries. And in a time of the climate crisis, you know, we really need everybody's help. So make sure and check out our website and find out how you can get involved and stop in the fossil fuel sector. But I want to personally just also point out and attend a protocol and, you know, acknowledge the local First Nations here in this territory, this beautiful sacred land. And just say, as a guest here in this territory, I'm very happy to be here. We've been very well taken care of. Tomorrow, we'll visit our friends up at Tsuki Pueblo and go and see some of the way that they've been, you know, protecting and preserving that sacred relationship to Mother Earth in their own way at their farm there. So I'm really, really excited about that. And I wanted to acknowledge those people of this land and, of course, those ancestors. And so, from the bottom of my heart, you know, welcome to In Pursuit of Cultural Freedom, the lecture series on political, economic, environmental, and human rights issues hosted by the Lannan Foundation. I'm really, really honored to be here, and wanted to give a big shout-out to all my friends from Santa Fe, especially the Bioneers community, you know, anybody out there. So, but let's cut to the chase. You know, we got a beautiful evening tonight planned. It's really quite an honor for me to share the stage with the leader and, you know, thinker and just inspiring person that I'm about to introduce this evening. And later on tonight, after his presentation, him and I will have an opportunity to have an intergenerational dialogue on some of the issues that he'll be bringing up this evening on the podium. Dr. David Suzuki is a scientist, he's an environmentalist, an author, a broadcaster, and co-founder of the David Suzuki Foundation, established in 1990 to work with government, business, and individuals to conserve our environment by providing scientific-based research, education, and policy work, and acting as a catalyst for change that today's situations demand. Recognized as a world leader in sustainable ecology, he is the recipient of numerous awards, including the 2009 Right Livelihood Award, the United Nations Environmental Program Global 500 Award, and UNESCO's Kalinga Prize for the popularization of science. Host of the long-running Canadian Broadcasting Corporation television program, The Nature of Things, he is also the author of more than 50 books. His newest, I know, eh? His newest work is Everything Under the Sun, Toward a Brighter Future on a Small Blue Planet, co-authored with his friend Ian Hannigson. Dr. Suzuki is a professor emeritus at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. And before I bring him out here, let me just say that, like so many other First Nations and Canadian people, you know, I grew up watching this guy on TV, and, you know, I can honestly say, you know, I grew up saying, I want to be that guy. That's who I want to do what he does. I want to fight to save Mother Earth. And so he popularized science. He popularized taking action, you know, for me in my life path. And, you know, I spend every single day now taking it to big oil. And a lot of reason that I do that is because of the inspiration I got from watching Dr. Suzuki on CBC, our Canadian public broadcasting channel in Canada. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Suzuki here to Santa Fe, to the Lenzic Center.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Clayton, we've got a lot to talk about after this talk. I'm honored and I'm delighted to have the opportunity this evening to share a few ideas with you. I first, please allow me to acknowledge and thank the Lannan Foundation for its generous support of many of our initiatives with First Nations in British Columbia. The Lannan Foundation has had an enormous impact in Canada, I can tell you. I want to speak to you today as an elder. You see, at my age, no one can accuse me of having a drive for power, money, or fame. Those are passé. Anybody who's an elder that's still after that, he's got a problem, I would think. And now that testosterone levels are dropping, so I don't think about sex all the time, I'm getting really smart. I believe elders have a very special place because we have something no other group in society has. We have had the experience of living an entire lifetime. Elders have suffered setbacks, I'm sure. We've made a lot of mistakes, celebrated a few successes. Our lives are full of lessons, lessons vital to pass on to the coming generation. So I urge my fellow elders to get off the couch, get off the golf course, and get on with the most important part of your lives. You see, we are at a remarkable moment in all of human history when what we do or do not do in the next few years will determine whether our species will survive into the next century. Now, that sounds like a pretty melodramatic statement. Don't take my word for it. How about Sir Martin Rees, the royal astronomer in England and eminent scientist who was asked on BBC a few years ago, what are the chances that human beings will be around by the end of this century? And his answer was 50-50. James Lovelock, the man who coined the term Gaia to explain life on the planet, has written a book in which he says by the end of this century, 90% of humanity will be gone. And finally, Clive Hamilton, an eco-philosopher from Australia, a man I have enormous respect for, has written a book called Requiem for a Species. And guess what species it's a requiem for? These are some of the people among many of my colleagues who are saying it's too late. We've passed too many tipping points to go back and to make out along a different path. What I say to those who say it's too late, thank you for giving us the message of the urgency of dealing with these issues we're trying to grapple with. But then please shut up and go away, because I don't see the point of saying it's too late. First of all, I don't think we know enough to say it's too late. But secondarily, even if it was, we're going to fight to the end to make a better world anyway. So what's the point? Today, human beings have become such a powerful force collectively that we are now altering the physical, chemical, and biological properties of the planet on a geological scale. That's why the Nobel laureate, Paul Crutzen, has said this is the Anthropocene epoch, a period during which one species, humanity, has become a geological force. The question is, how did we arrive at this amazing moment in time? I'm a geneticist by training, so I've been astounded to watch the way scientists have used DNA to track or trace the movement of our species over time. And all of the trails lead back to Africa 150,000 years ago. I can't wait to be invited by the Ku Klux Klan to give a lecture and tell these pointy-headed characters, we're all Africans, for heaven's sakes. That's where we were born. Try to imagine the world when our species appeared. There were still woolly mammoths on the planet. There were saber-toothed tigers. The world was a very different place. And I imagine that the great savannas of Africa must have been filled with animals in abundance and variety beyond anything we can imagine from the Serengeti today. And here and there were little pockets of three, four, five of these funny-looking two-legged naked apes, and that was us. Now, I'm sure no other species looked at us, trembled, and said, watch out for them, they're going to take over the planet. I mean, what did we have going for us? There weren't many of us. We weren't big, fast, strong. We didn't have special senses. And the point is that our secret, the key to our great success, was not visible. It was a 2-kilogram organ buried deep in our skulls. The human brain that conferred a massive memory, curiosity, and inventiveness. That brain enabled us to create order out of chaos in the world that we saw around. That brain learned by trial and error. And it did something no other species has ever done. It invented an idea called the future. Future doesn't exist. Just what exists is now and what we remember from the past. But because we invented the notion of a future, we are the only creature that realized we could shape the future by what we do today. Based on our experience and knowledge, we can look ahead, see where the dangers lie, see where the opportunities are, and deliberately decide today to avoid dangers and exploit opportunities. I believe foresight was a great advantage that we had over any other creatures. And because of foresight, we were able to move across the planet and occupy every continent and become the dominant creature on Earth. And suddenly, very, very suddenly, we have exploded into a geological force. If we were around as a species for 150,000 years, there were never a billion human beings for most of that period. It wasn't until the early 1800s that there were a billion human beings on the planet. I was born in 1936, when there were just over 2 billion people. Can you imagine that within my lifetime, within a single human life, the population has more than tripled? And every one of the 7 billion of us now has to breathe air, drink water, eat food, clothe and shelter ourselves. So just the act of living, staying alive, means that we have an enormous ecological footprint. That is, it takes a lot of air, water and land to support 7 billion of us. We are the most numerous mammal on the planet. But of course, we're not like rabbits or rats or mice. We have an enormous amount of technology used on our behalf. As I look out, I have to squint to see you all out there, but as I look out at the audience, I see a lot of people in wool and cotton clothes. I am absolutely sure there isn't a single one of you with a flock of sheep in your backyard or growing a field of cotton plants. It's technology that enables us to live as we do, to live in Santa Fe, far beyond the capacity of this area to support the population that you have. It's technology and the ability to deliver materials that we need from all over the world. And that amplifies, through technology, our ecological footprint. And of course, we have an economy now based on consumption, where 70% of the North American economy depends on consumer products. 97% of American teenage girls now consider shopping their number one recreation. Shopping, consuming is what we are about today, and that everything that we consume comes out of the earth. And when we're done with it, we throw it back in. And that, again, escalates our ecological footprint. And finally, we have a global economy that exploits the entire planet as a source of raw materials that deposits our waste and toxic materials back into that planet. So when you add all of those things up, our numbers, our technology, our consumption, and a global economy, we have become a global force on the planet that is now collectively undermining the very life support systems of the planet. Scientists for over 40 years have been acting in the best tradition of our species, using their knowledge and expertise, using supercomputers, and looking ahead, seeing where the dangers lie and the opportunities are. And for over 40 years, they've been telling us we are headed down a very dangerous path. Let me give you one example of the kind of warnings that we've been receiving. This is a document that was published in November of 1992. It's called World Scientists Warning to Humanity. And when you look at the list of scientists, these are the top scientists of the world, more than 1,700 scientists from 71 countries in the world, including over half of all living Nobel Prize winners at that time. So it's a pretty impressive group of people. What are they warning us about in 1992? Let me read you from the document. Human beings and the natural world are on a collision course. Human activities inflict harsh and often irreversible damage on the environment and on critical resources. If not checked, many of our current practices put at serious risk the future we wish for human society and may so alter the living world that it will be unable to sustain life in the manner that we know. Fundamental changes are urgent. If we are to avoid the collision, our present course will bring about. And then they go on and list the areas of collision: the atmosphere, water resources, oceans, soil, forests, species, and population. And then the words grow even more bleak. No more than one or a few decades remain before the chance to avert the threats we now confront will be lost, and the prospects for humanity immeasurably diminished. A great change in our stewardship of the earth and life on it is required if vast human misery is to be avoided and our global home on this planet is not to be irretrievably mutilated. And then they tell us the five things that we must do and begin immediately. This is a frightening document. But I'll tell you, scientists are not in the business of signing such strongly worded documents. But if this is frightening, the response of the media around the world was terrifying. There was no response. In Canada, our national newspaper and our national broadcaster, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, dismissed this as not newsworthy. Excuse me. Over half of all Nobel Prize winners saying we may have as little as 10 years to avoid a catastrophe, and this is not newsworthy. And let's remind ourselves of what is newsworthy. You ever heard of Brad and Angelina? You ever heard of Lindsay Lohan? Think of the sports, Lance Armstrong and who won the World Series. And of course, every pronouncement from an economist or a corporate executive is reported in breathless detail, but not when half of all Nobel Prize winners tell us we face a catastrophe. And I must say, listening to the debates in the United States over the last couple of months, I have to say it doesn't sound much different now than it did in 1992 when this document occurred. Why in the world can't we see what's happening? The powerful position we've acquired and the warnings of the leading scientists of the world about the dangers that we now confront, especially in the area of global warming. Well, I believe the problem is that the way we see the world through the perspective of our values and our beliefs. And it is our current worldview, that perspective today, that is the cause of our destructiveness. In the environmental movement has fundamentally failed to shift the way that we see the world and ourselves in it. We call this a paradigm shift. We haven't brought it about. And this year, as you know, is the 50th anniversary of the modern environmental movement. Rachel Carson published Silent Spring in 1962. We see the world through the lenses of our values and our beliefs. Many years ago, I visited a tiny village on the side of a mountain in the Andes in Peru. And I learned that the children in this village are taught that the mountain their village is on is an apu. Apu in their language means God. And as long as that Apu casts its shadow on the village, it will determine the destiny of everyone in that village. And I thought, wow. Imagine the way those kids, when they grow up, treat that mountain compared to someone from Gunnison, Colorado, who grows up in the Rockies, taught all his life that those mountains are full of gold or silver. Is a forest a sacred grove or simply lumber and pulp? Is a river the circulatory system of the land, or is it simply an opportunity for power or irrigation? Is another species our biological relative or simply a resource? Is the soil a community of organisms or just dirt? Is the biosphere our home or is it simply an opportunity? The way we see the world shapes the way that we treat it. For 95% of human existence, we were nomadic hunter-gatherers. And when you're a nomad following plants and animals through the seasons, you know very, very well that we are utterly dependent on the natural world for our survival and well-being. So for most of human existence, we understood our place in nature and our dependence on nature. In the last 5% of our existence, the last 10,000 years, we had the agricultural revolution that transformed the way that humanity lives. For most of that last 10,000 years, we've been a farming species. In 1900, when there were 1.5 billion people in the world, most people in the world, including in North America, lived in rural village communities. You could find all through the Midwest tiny communities of 150, 200 people living, spotted all across the Midwest. Why? Because we were farmers. Because most people in the world were involved in some aspect of agriculture. Farmers understand very well the seasons, weather, climate. We're utterly dependent on these for our well-being and our survival. Farmers know the amount of snow in the winter is directly related to the amount of moisture in the soil, in the summer. Farmers know some insects are pests, but we need insects to pollinate flowering plants. They know that some species of plants and trees take nitrogen from the air, fix it as fertilizer in the soil. Farmers understand that we are dependent on the natural world. Something fundamentally different happened in the last 100 years. By the year 2000, when there were now 6 billion people in the world, there were 80 to 85% of us living in the industrialized countries now lived in big cities. Over half of all of humanity by the year 2000 lived in cities. So in only 100 years, we were changed from a farming animal into a big city dweller. And in a big city, it becomes easy to think we're not like other species. I mean, we're so smart, we create our own habitat. You know, and as long as we have a few parks out there where we can go camping and skiing and playing, who needs nature? You know, we're city folk. I have a friend that lives in the northern end of Toronto, biggest city in Canada. And he told me he lives in a high-rise apartment, completely air-conditioned. He said, I go down the elevator in the morning, get into my car in the basement, it's completely air-conditioned, drive down the Don Valley Freeway downtown, into the basement of my commercial building, into an air-conditioned office. That building is connected through tunnels to all kinds of shopping areas and food markets. He said to me, David, I don't have to go outside for weeks. Who needs nature? We create our own habitat. And so as city dwellers, our highest priority becomes our job. We need a job to earn the money to buy the things that we want. Note I said want, not need. Because most of the stuff we buy, we don't need. It's just what we want. And so the economy then becomes our priority as an urban species. Now, we seem to forget that the very word economy comes from the Greek word oikos, meaning household or domain. Our domain as a species is the biosphere, the zone of air, water, and land where all living things exist. Economics is the management of our domain. Ecology comes from the same root word, and ecology is the study of our domain or our household. And what ecologists try to do is determine what are the conditions, the principles, and the laws that enable a species to survive and flourish. Now, I would have thought any organization, any corporation, any government, before beginning a new program, would say, wait a minute now, have you checked with those ecologists? Because we don't want to do anything that's going to violate those principles or those laws. But what we do is we say, no, 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 we can't afford to do that. The economy then becomes even more important than the very principles that ecologists are telling us about. We elevate the economy when we tell us, when we say, we can't afford to stop clear-cut logging. It's the only way we can be globally competitive. We can't afford to stop those trawlers that are dragging heavy weights across the bottom of the ocean because we can't compete with fishing fleets in other parts of the world. We can't afford to reduce greenhouse gases because it'll destroy the economy. So we elevate the economy above the very things that keep us alive. So let's put the eco back into economics. We seem to forget where that word came from. But if the economy is our highest priority, and certainly Mr. Romney and Mr. Obama indicated very strongly that was their highest priority, shouldn't we be asking a few fundamental questions like, what is an economy for? Are there no limits? What does all this growth in the economy mean to improve our lives? We keep saying it's got to have growth, growth, but why? What good is that doing for us? How much is enough? Are we happier with all this stuff? I mean, we're not asking the fundamental questions that we should if the economy is indeed our highest priority. My great inspiration was Rachel Carson. And because of Rachel Carson, I became swept up in the environmental movement like millions of people around the world. And what I've, looking back over my life, being involved in environmental things, is that I was fortunate to be involved in a small way with a number of issues. For example, every time Congress threatened to put a rider on a bill that would allow Alaska to drill for oil in ANWR, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, I cranked up the Nature of Things and we did a show about that area from an ecological standpoint. ANWR is the calving grounds of the porcupine caribou herd. And each time I like to think that our programs helped to beat back the threat of drilling in ANWR. Don't clap right away because I've got the bottom line is not what you'd think because of Sarah Palin. I joined with the First Nations and there was a proposal to drill for oil in Heckett Strait, the narrow channel between Haida Gwaii and the mainland, and there is very treacherous waters, and we stopped the proposal to drill for oil. There was a proposal to bring Alaskan oil down along through the coast of British Columbia on the way to Seattle or Washington, and we stopped that. We stopped a dam on the at Site C on the Peace River. And Tara, my wife, and I joined with the Kayapo people in Brazil in a massive demonstration that stopped Brazil's program to build the Carau Dam in Altamira, Brazil. These we celebrated as great triumphs. But today, 30 to 35 years later, we are fighting the same battles that we celebrated as victories 35 years ago. Sarah Palin told us it's drill, baby, drill. And Mr. Obama seems to be affected by that proposal. The proposal to drill for oil in Heckett Strait is back on. The dam at Site C on the Peace River and in Altamira are both being built now. And the pipeline from Alberta that will take the oil from the tar sands to the coast of British Columbia to load into supertankers. We banned supertankers, and now it's all back on the agenda. So what we celebrated as great victories were simply skirmishes that didn't fundamentally change the way that we see our relationship with the rest of the biosphere. We didn't shift the paradigm. And that's the reason many people are saying that the environmental movement, despite the enormous success in the first three decades, has fundamentally failed in what should have been our goal of shifting that paradigm. My environmentalism has developed over many decades now, fighting. We were fighting for cleaner air, cleaner water, fighting to protect forests, fighting for a better future. But the problem today is that when there's a fight, there's always a winner or loser. And now as we talk about the fate of the biosphere for humankind, I don't think that we can afford to have losers. And so the challenge, I believe, now is we've got to come together, but we've got to leave our vested interests outside the door. It doesn't work when we come together as stakeholders and try to fight it out over what program is going to win out. It involves compromise or sacrifice. We can't afford to do that. And I say we have to come together, and we now have to ask, can we begin from a position of agreement? Let's agree on the fundamental things on which we will build our platforms of politics or economics. So let's start by setting a bottom line that is dictated by the laws of nature. We live in a world that is defined and shaped by laws of nature. Physicists tell us that we know that the speed of light puts a limit on how fast we can build a space rocket. We can't go faster than the speed of light. Nobody objects to that. You know, we live within that. We know that the law of gravity says you can't have an anti-gravity machine here on Earth. And we know the first and second laws of thermodynamics tell us that you can't build a perpetual motion machine. We all understand that. That's the world, the real world, that we live in. In chemistry, it's the same thing. There are laws governing the rate of reactions, diffusion constants, the atomic properties of the elements that determine the kinds of chemical reactions we can perform in a test tube, the kinds of molecules that we can synthesize. Those are all dictated to us by the laws of chemistry, and we live within those principles. In biology, it's the same thing. We know that there are carrying capacities of ecosystems, that ecosystems can flourish as long as predators, you know, with living within that ecosystem do not undermine the ability of those ecosystems to sustain themselves over time. Human beings are the most powerful predators on the planet, and we live at the very top of the ecological food chain. So that we have to pay attention to what are the carrying capacities of the various ecosystems around the world we occupy. That has to be the case. And the most important thing for us to remember and agree on is that we are biological creatures. And our biological nature dictates what our most fundamental needs are. We are animals. I gave a lecture in Austin, Texas, many years ago when they had the first annual Green Builders Association meeting. Big meeting. And I lectured to, I think there were 3,000 people. A lot of kids in the audience. And I said, you know, kids, if you remember one thing from this talk, remember we are animals. I was shocked. Their parents are so pissed off at me. Don't you dare call my daughter an animal. We're human beings. You know, we somehow feel that we're elevated above the rest of the living world. I mean, and you can see it. If you call someone a chicken or a pig or an ape or a snake or a worm, I mean, these are all insults, right? Because somehow we think we're, you know, above those other creatures. But, you know, we are a species like any other species. And anybody in biology will tell you we belong to the kingdom Animalia. We belong to the phylum Chordata. We belong to the phylum class, mammalia, the order. Order may be above class. I'm not sure. Primates, hominidae, Homo sapiens. You can classify us all the way down to genus and species. We're an organism like any other creature, And because we are animals, our most fundamental need is dictated to us by that reality or that fact. The very first thing we needed, the moment every one of us left our mother's body, was a breath of air. And from that moment on, 15 to 40 times a minute, we need air until the last breath we take before we die. If we don't have air for 3 or 4 minutes, you're either dead or you're brain dead. If we have polluted air that we live within, you're sick. So I can't imagine anyone that could disagree with me that air is the most fundamental need that we have, that must be protected above anything else, will be the air that gives us life and lets us flourish throughout our lives. And then, of course, as animals, we are 70% water by weight. We're just a big blob of water with enough thickener added so we don't dribble away on the floor. Right? And we have to top up all the time because the water leaks out of our bodies and our skin and our eyes and our mouth and our crotch, and we're losing water. And so, you know, we top it up with water. And where does that water come from? You think it's Santa Fe water? Of course not. The hydrologic cycle says water cartwheels around the planet. So when you take a drink of water, it contains molecules from every ocean on the planet, every canopy of forests around the world. And that water then, if you go without water for more than a few days, you're dead. If you drink polluted water, you're sick. So again, surely water should be right up there with air as our most fundamental need that we have to protect at all costs. And then, of course, without food for more than a few weeks, we're dead. If you eat food that's poisoned or polluted, you're sick. So every bit of the food that we eat for our nutrition was once alive, and most of it was grown in the soil. We take carcasses of plants and animals, tear them apart in our mouths, and incorporate the molecules in those plants and animals into our very essence. And we think that we're intelligent, but we use the soil as a garbage can for our toxic materials. Indeed, we will spray or inject toxic stuff into the plants or animals that we're going to eat. We are the earth through the food that we consume. Surely the earth should be one of our highest priorities. And every bit of the energy in our bodies, every bit of it that we need to move and grow and reproduce, all of that energy is sunlight. Sunlight captured by plants through photosynthesis and converted into chemical energy. And then we get that energy by eating the plants or eating the animals that eat that plants, and we store it in our bodies. And when we need that energy, we burn it to get the energy from the sun back out. So surely protecting photosynthetic activity around the planet is absolutely vital to our well-being and survival. And the amazing thing is, what delivers clean air, clean water, clean soil, clean food, and clean energy from the sun is the web of living things around the earth, what biologists call biodiversity. It's life itself that cleanses, replenishes, or creates the most fundamental needs that we have. To me, I defy any corporate leader, politician, anybody, even the Tea Party, I'm sure, would have to agree that as biological beings, air, water, soil, that photosynthesis and biodiversity have got to be in our best interests, our most fundamental needs that we have to protect and nourish. That's how we begin to build our system of needs, on which we then ask, how do we create an economy? How do we make a living? Protecting those absolutely fundamental needs. So those are realities dictated by the physical, chemical, and biological world, the principles that emerge from these sciences. Other things that we pay a lot of attention to are not in the same category. But we've puffed ourselves up so much, we think things that we create are more important than our most fundamental biological needs. We draw lines around our property, around our cities, our townships, our counties, our, our states and our countries. And boy, do we take those seriously. I gather in Texas, if someone comes onto your property, you can shoot and kill them. Because those property lines are bloody important. We go to war. We kill and die protecting those boundaries. But you know what? Nature couldn't give two hoots about human borders. I mean, I go to Alberta all the time and I tell Albertans, look, I don't care what you do with the tar sands. You can dig them up, burn them, poison the rivers and lakes. All I say is, whatever you do to the tar sands stays within Alberta. You guys think your boundaries are important. Keep it for yourselves. Well, of course, nature doesn't obey or pay any attention to our boundaries. When you think of the hydrologic cycle, water circulates, air blows around the planet. It's a single system. Dust blows from Africa across to North America. Then you think of all the migrating animals and plants that come across borders. Nature doesn't give two hoots about human borders. And yet we manage nature and we try to shoehorn nature into our boundaries. It's crazy because you can't do it that way. Nature doesn't operate that way. And then we go even further. We invent ideas like capitalism, like the economy, like corporations, the market. My God, you talk to a neoconservative and they may seem perfectly normal until you finally you mention the market. Watch them. Their faces just light up, their eyes glaze over, and they go, the market, hallelujah, praise the market, free the market, let the market do. Wait a minute now, we invented the damn thing. It's not a force of nature. You know, 300 years ago, people believed in dragons and demons. And they really believed in them. They would toss them gold and jewelry and sacrifice virgins, anything to keep the dragons or demons off their back. Well, today, nobody believes in dragons or demons. I mean, we know they're figments of our imagination. But what do? We replace them with another one. Just listen to the debates that went on for the last months. It's all about the economy. It's all about the free market. But these are inventions of the human mind. And yet, look at what we do. 2008, Mr. Bush, Mr. Obama tossed hundreds of billions of dollars into the banks that created the problem in the first place, just to get that economy back up running. Wait a minute now. They're like dragons and demons, for heaven's sakes. We invented them. And if they don't work, those are the only things we can change. We can't change nature. So we've got to really look at the real world and see what is real and what are human constructs. You only have to look at what happened in Copenhagen 2 years ago. 192 countries gathered in Copenhagen to deal with the atmosphere that belongs to no one. They tried to make nature conform to 192 national borders and 192 economic agendas. We can't do it. It can't work that way so long as we are so puffed up. We think that the things that we invent are just as important as the laws of nature. Okay, I spent a lot of time saying the dilemma, the problem that we face, is there a way out? And I see real change, real excitement happening in Latin America. Now, I know in America you don't like to hear this, but Cuba. Cuba is an example where they were deliberately kept out of the global economy by the United States. As long as Russia was there to buy their sugar at premium prices and provide them with all the oil they wanted, they were laughing. It was great. When Russia blew apart, Cuba was in a tremendous dilemma. I mean, they had no oil. They couldn't even bring the food from the countryside into the city. They had no oil. And out of that came this incredible experience where Fidel Castro said, if you see an empty lot in the city and you're willing to grow food on it, take it. If you don't know how to do it, I'll send people to help you. If you don't have the tools, we'll give you the tools. And what came out of that terrible experience for Cuba was this amazing agricultural movement where urban agriculture in Cuba now supplies 80% of the food in Cuba. That is, if you go to Havana, 80% of the food you eat in Havana is grown in Havana. It's fresh, organic, and it's grown by local city dwellers. That's an example that is spreading around the world. But it is Bolivia and Ecuador where I am very, very heartened by what's going on. Bolivia, the poorest country in South America, has elected the first indigenous person as the president of the country, Evo Morales. And Evo is really constantly raising Pachamama, Mother Earth, and saying that we must care for Pachamama because Pachamama is so generous to us. And has done just amazing critiques of the so-called green economy and how this is simply another form of capitalism and that we need to break out of that kind of economic trap that we get caught up in. And in Ecuador, which is an even more amazing experience, Ecuador has a president, Rafael Correa, who was trained, he has a PhD in economics from the United States. And the pride and joy of Ecuador is Yasuni National Park on the east side of the Andes in the headwaters of the Amazon. And for some reason I won't go into, the Yasuni is the most biodiverse area on the planet. In 1 hectare of Yasuni National Park, they discovered more species of trees than in all of North America, from Mexico to Alaska. Anyway, the Ecuadorians are very, very proud of Yasuni. And a few years ago, they discovered there's oil under Yasuni National Park. $7 billion worth of oil. And Correa said, well, if we dig up the oil, we'll destroy the park. And if we then burn it, we'll simply add to global warming. So we're going to leave that oil in the ground. He said that we're a poor country, huge pressure on us to develop resources, to exploit various parts of nature. We will leave it in the ground, and we will absorb the half of the cost of that oil. That is, we won't go for $3.5 billion. But will the rest of the world help support us to leave that oil in the ground? So they set up a fund in the United Nations. That fund will take the money that comes in, and Bolivia will only take the interest. If a Bolivian government, after Correa leaves, if another government comes in and says, we're going to dig that oil up, we need that oil, then all of that money will go back to the countries that gave the money in the first place. He has asked whether countries will give $300 million a year for the next 10 years. So this is called the Yasuni ITT project. This is the first year they've raised $300 million. So let's hope that they can show that by leading the world in this way, they can actually leave the oil in the ground and yet benefit from that oil in what the country, rest of the world does to keep it, the oil deposited. You know, and it humiliates me to live in one of the richest countries on the planet, Canada, and we just can't wait to dig it out. And we say, oh, yeah, we'll have carbon capture and storage. Wait a minute, nature already did it. The tar sands oil is carbon captured and stored in the ground. Why do you want to dig it up, burn it, and then go, oh, we got to capture it, put it back in the ground. It's already down there. But no, we won't follow a poor country like Ecuador. What Correa did when he was elected, he said, we need a new kind of constitution. So if you elect me, I will revise the constitution. And guess what? In the constitution, they enshrined Pachamama. In other words, what that says is that rivers and forests and fish and birds have a constitutional right to exist. Now you can say, this is an economist, for heaven's sakes. And in the southern part of Ecuador is a river called the Vilcabamba River. And it's reputed to have special powers so that people that live on that water live longer. So naturally, there are a lot of Americans gone down there to live because they think, oh boy, I'm going to find long life. Anyway, one of the One of the American couples that lives on the Vilcabamba noticed a couple of years ago that a road building company was dumping all of the gravel and sand and boulders into the river. And it was causing the river to narrow, so the water was flowing much more quickly. And then there was a big rain, and that water shot around and flooded and destroyed their plantation and much of their property. So they were, as you might expect, mightily upset. So they kept asking the officials to do something. Nothing happened. So they then sued, because Pachamama is guaranteed under the Constitution. They sued the road building company on behalf of Pachamama, the river. Now, because they're suing for the river, they can't claim any money. But what they can claim is the right for that river to exist. They won their suit, and that road company now has to restore the river to its original condition. Not bad. And so I think it's very interesting that in Latin America, there are many, many things going on, including in Colombia, in Peru, in a number of countries, some very, very exciting new ways of looking through lenses that are not driven by economics. And finally, I will just mention, because I've gone on long enough, I would just mention this tiny kingdom of Bhutan. And I'm sure most of you have heard of Bhutan. Today there are 500,000 people living in this kingdom that is surrounded by the Himalayan mountains. Now they're squeezed by these two giants, these behemoths of China and India. And in order to keep from becoming political pawns between these two countries, they just hunkered down behind the mountains. So for literally centuries, nobody knew that Bhutan existed. So now people think of Bhutan as the Shangri-La, you know, this magical kingdom. But they were just doing their thing as farmers and living as they always did. In 1961, they realized that something, the world was changing, and they had to find out what was going on. So they selected 100 kids at random and sent them out to schools in India to be educated, and then sent to schools like Oxford and Cambridge, Harvard and Stanford. And they came back and they began to send hundreds and hundreds of kids out to be educated in the real world. And when they came back to Bhutan, they said, it's really weird. They're all operating out there in the real world on this idea that development is all about growth in the GDP and stuff. Like, they were shocked at this fact. And they said, we don't want that kind of that's not what we think development is. Of course we need development, but just stuff, that's not what we want. In 2006, the king of Bhutan, who was greatly loved by his people, said, you know, it's a very dangerous thing when you have a hereditary kingship. Because you never know whether some guy is born in the family, and just because he's born in the right pedigree, he gets to be king. He might be a total jerk. You need to have democracy, because if you elect your leaders and he turns out to be a dud, you can boot him out. Just get him out in the next election. So he said, I quit. And the people were upset, and they said, why? And he said, because I want you to ensure that you don't have this bad experience. But he said, you know, the reason kings and governments exist is to ensure the well-being and the happiness of people. It's not about stuff or growth in the economy or any of that. And in April 2 this year, Jigme Tinley, the Prime Minister of Bhutan, went to the United Nations and introduced the only resolution Bhutan has ever introduced at the UN, that well-being of all life and happiness be the goal of governments. And this was immediately signed on up. 68 countries signed up immediately. But they said, well, what does it mean to be happy? You know, we think of happiness as this kind of joyous, oh, God, I feel great. And, you know, I just went skiing and I feel... No, that's not what he's talking about. It's a much deeper thing about, you know, feeling content or satisfied or having a great sense of place in society and in the things you do. I mean, people said, you've got to define what it is in terms that any people would understand. What is well-being of life? What is happiness? How do you measure it? And how do you develop a strategy for governments to work towards that? And they've set up 4 working groups to work on various aspects of well-being and happiness. And they're all charged with completing their work in 2 years, at which time Bhutan will present this as a full-blown recommendation to the United Nations. And for me, who has long battled in the environmental movement, I believe this is the game changer. This is the paradigm shift. In fact, their submission is a new paradigm of development. And this gets us off the idea that the economy is everything. It's the goal or the end. No, the economy has to be a means of getting to some higher end. And this one, I believe, could be one. So there is opportunity there to begin a radical shift in the way that we see the world. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org.